I am Loretta Lynch Reichert, Director of Research Communications at the Medical University of South Carolina and host of MUSC's Science Cafe, a monthly program focused on biomedical research that seeks to answer our toughest healthcare questions. Never has that quest been more urgent. In this era of the COVID-19 pandemic, we remain committed to engaging the public and positively influencing our community's health and well-being. And so, for the foreseeable future, we will bring you Science Cafe through the ingenuity of podcasts. Pull up your favorite chair, pour your favorite beverage, and let's hear from some of MUSC's most talented and innovative biomedical researchers, all from the comfort of your home. On this month's cafe, we focus on health disparity, what it is, why it is, and why it matters to us all, especially now. Joining us today is a nationally recognized expert on health disparity, Dr. Marvella Ford. Dr. Ford is a professor of public health sciences and associate director of population sciences and cancer disparities at MUSC's Hollings Cancer Center. Welcome, Dr. Ford.
Thank you so much for having me today. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're pleased to have you. Tell us how you define health disparity and why is it such a passion for you?
Well, health disparities generally refer to having a population that experiences a higher burden of illness, injury, disability, or mortality in relation to another group. And so typically that means that some groups bear an unequal burden of disease than compared to other groups.
Why for you is this such a passion?
Health disparities research is a real passion for me personally because all of my grandparents died before I was born. So I never had an opportunity to get to know any of them. I've only seen pictures of one of them. And so I felt a real gap growing up. And when I asked about how they had died, no one knew because in those days, people didn't really delve into the cause of death. They just knew someone had died. And so that made me really want to conduct research to try to understand the contributors to health disparities so that we could try to reduce or eliminate those disparities so that other people could spend a lot more time with their grandparents and other family members would have more time.
That's a lovely sentiment and a tragedy that actually it sounds like is bearing some fruit. I'd like to delve more broadly into your extensive research on the topic, but we can't ignore the headlines these days regarding the alarming statistics of COVID-19 and how it disproportionately affects minorities. Can you speak to that?
Yes, absolutely. So we know that health disparities refer to the unequal burden of disease, but health care disparities refer to unequal access to health care. And what we've seen is that the underlying contributors disparities in COVID-19 outcomes are really, really, really related to disparities in health and disparities in healthcare access. And so if we look at South Carolina, for example, if we look at the people who've died from COVID-19 in South Carolina, and more than 100 people have died, what we see is that 57% of those who have died are African American. And that is a disparity because African Americans only make up 12% of the entire South Carolina population. So when you see a population that only makes up 12% of the total state population, but reflects 57% of the deaths, that tells us that we're looking at a huge racial and ethnic disparity in COVID-19 deaths in our state. And this is not unique to our state. This is occurring on a national level as well. And in states that have large populations of Latinx communities, such as New York. In New York City, Latinx communities are driving the disparities, and they have the highest death rates of any other group. But here in South Carolina, African Americans are the overwhelming minority group. And so that's where we're seeing a lot of these just huge disparities in death rate due to COVID-19.
Dr. Ford, what other factors are there that contribute to health disparities?
So when we look at the COVID-19 disparities and we see the disproportionate death rate among African Americans in our state, What we see is that there are many contributors to those disproportionate COVID-19 death rates among African Americans. This is a population in South Carolina that has experienced very high rates of diabetes, hypertension, stroke, and lung disease. And one point that I would like to make is that when we talk about racial and ethnic disparities in South Carolina, we have to first discuss the geographic disparities in our state. And so when you compare South Carolina to other parts of the U.S., such as Minnesota or California, even if you're white and you live in South Carolina, your chance of dying from cancer or diabetes or hypertension or stroke is higher than it would be if you were white and living in Minnesota, or if you were white and living in California. So just the fact of living in South Carolina means that we have geographic disparities in our state compared to the health outcomes of other states. When we talk about racial and ethnic disparities in South Carolina, we're actually layering an entire other layer of disparities on top of the already existing geographic disparities. And that's why racial and ethnic disparities in China and other states like Alabama, Mississippi, and Tennessee are huge. They're enormous because they are layered on top of geographic disparities in these states. And one of the issues in our state is that not only do we have high rates of cancer, diabetes, hypertension, and stroke in our population in general, and especially in the African American community, but a lot of people are walking around thinking that they're fine and they have undiagnosed diabetes or undiagnosed high blood pressure, or they're about to have a stroke and they aren't even aware that they're at risk of having a stroke. So when we have a lot of people in our community who have diagnosed disease, and then we have another large group with undiagnosed disease, that makes us ripe for COVID-19, not only infection, but to have poorer outcomes from the infection than if we were starting with a healthier population to begin with.
So one of the reasons we do Science Cafe is because we want to inform the public and we want to engage them, especially with regard to the biomedical research we do at MUSC. So can you tell me what you think the role of health professionals and researchers is in addressing this issue, at least here in South Carolina? And are you making any headway?
Absolutely. So as researchers, we are identifying the factors that contribute to health disparities. And the science has really come a long way in the last 30 years, because now there's a greater understanding that these health disparities are multifactorial, meaning there are several causes that contribute to health disparities. There's biology, there are social factors, there's psychological factors. And so what's happening now, and it's really an exciting time to be doing health disparities research, is that on a national level, the National Institutes of Health, the organizations that are part of the NIH are starting to fund transdisciplinary science. So basically on a team, you might have a behavioral scientist and a biologist and a chemistry expert and an immunology expert, because there's an understanding that we need expertise in multiple areas so that we can come together, share the lens through which we look at the world. But first of all, identify points of disparities and then develop solutions. So one example is biological factors and disparities may include genetic factors such as ancestry, your racial or ethnic background, and your family history. Social factors are looking at more systemic items like poor access to high quality healthcare, poor access to education, lower income levels, lack of health insurance coverage, and then experiences of discrimination. And psychological factors are looking at things like perceived stress, depression, coping strategies, trust or mistrust of healthcare professionals, and health knowledge. And so what we know now is that the solutions to health disparities may come from all of these different disciplinary perspectives, and we need to all come to the table to figure out what the points of intervention are. So from a biological level, it may be possible that there may be biological mechanisms that look different in different population groups. My good colleague, Dr. David Turner, does a lot of great work on advanced glycation end products. Those are the byproducts of metabolism, and they appear to be associated with risk of developing cancer and also risk of having a cancer recurrence. And what he's found is that these age levels, AGE, advanced glycation end product levels, are higher in African Americans in non-tumor tissue and in cancer tumor tissue. The great thing is there are lifestyle and behavioral factors, interventions that we can create that could reduce the age levels in people. So that's kind of a combination of a biologic and a social psychological interweaving, where we identify the biological source of potential disparity, and we develop a behavioral intervention that could reduce the disparity.
So it sounds like the cliche, if you will, it takes a village, is what this team science is all about. And my question to you is, from the community or individual perspective, how are they perceiving this message and this opportunity?
Well, that's a great question, and it's really exciting because the community members always ask us for information. And as you know, research is incremental. So we make incremental progress, but when you look at a body of work altogether, it looks like a lot. So we're always trying to figure out how to craft messages for community members that encompass the current research, but also that won't overpromise where the research is going. So the great thing about this example of advanced glycation end products is that Dr. Turner has prepared a very community-friendly presentation, and I've worked closely with him in my role as Associate Director of Population Sciences and Cancer Disparities and Director of Community Outreach and Engagement for the Hollings Cancer Center, in working with him to link him with community groups who can participate in the presentation about advanced glycation end products, because there are a lot of dietary changes that we can make to lower our age level. Bacon is loaded with ages. So if we just cut out bacon, or reduce the amount of bacon that we eat, we can lower our age levels. Fried foods are high in ages. So we can, you know, instead of frying, we can bake our food. There are a lot of great behavioral changes that we can make related to reducing our age levels that the community members love to hear about. And it's so exciting because what we found is that in the rural and medically underserved communities of South Carolina, as well as other communities, people want to make changes to become healthier, but often we don't know how and we don't know where to start. So when we get information that we can take from the more conceptual level and break it down into plain language and tie it directly to specific actions that community members can take to improve their own health, they get excited about these changes and we get excited about the changes.
I'm sure of it. It's interesting. I'd like to ask you, before we go into more general detail about health disparities and how MUSC is leading the way, we can talk about solutions that are available and sharing them with the communities. But for instance, food deserts. Unless you have access to food, the healthy vegetables, the fruits, that sort of thing, what's the promise of the kind of community outreach you do in those areas that really don't have the resources to improve themselves, even if they have the knowledge and the desire?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. So we work closely with our community partners. And what we try to do while making changes, of course, we are constantly working with our legislators to make policy-related changes to eradicate food deserts. But in the meantime, we work with communities with what we have. And so what we've noticed is that in a lot of rural areas of South Carolina, most of those areas have a dollar store. They go by different names, but they're called dollar stores. And those often, sometimes in communities, are the meeting place, gathering places. But what we remind people in the community is that a lot of the dollar stores have a grocery section. And in that section, they have freezers. And in those freezers, they have frozen fruits and vegetables. And so we remind people that frozen fruits and vegetables are very healthy. They're flash frozen. So they retain, those foods retain a lot of nutrients and a lot of nutritional value. Then we have to talk about cooking, because if you're used to cooking with fresh vegetables and now you're cooking with frozen vegetables, there are different techniques that you have to use. So we talk about cooking and how we can use these frozen vegetables and frozen fruits to make healthy meals for our families. So I think, you know, coming up with creative solutions, building on what's in the community. The other thing we have to keep in mind is that South Carolina has at least two growing seasons because of our climate. And so there are a lot of kind of unofficial farmers markets that pop up in rural areas all during the year, mainly in the summer and fall. But there are people on the roadsides with pickup trucks with wonderfully fresh and delicious, fresh from the field, fruits and vegetables that we can get for a pretty inexpensive price. And for those areas that have official farmers markets, we let people in the community know that most of the farmers markets take EBT cards. And EBT cards are what we call food stamps, the old food stamps program. So most vendors at more traditional farmers markets are set up to scan those EBT cards. That's another excellent location where people can have access to fresh fruits and vegetables. And again, it's not to diminish the need to continue working with our legislators to eradicate the food deserts. But simultaneously, while we're working on the legislative level, we're also working on the community level to try to bring together some of the existing resources that are there.
There is such a need, and I'm so grateful that you are joining us today, Dr. Ford.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. How are you and your team moving the needle across South Carolina? Tell us about some of the collaborative programs you're working on, and what are the economic and social impacts of health disparities?
So South Carolina has a great resource in our Hollings Cancer Center, because for many years, the Hollings Cancer Center was far ahead of the curve in terms of understanding the need to reach out to rural, minority, and medically underserved communities. And currently, the National Cancer Institute has made it a requirement of National Cancer Institute designated cancer centers to include a community outreach and engagement component. But again, the Hollings Cancer Center was ahead of the curve because this work had been going on for decades here in South Carolina. We also have a lot of great community partners that we work with, other academic institutions, the South Carolina Cancer Alliance, and of course, the Department of Health and Environmental Control, or DHEC. And so what's great about living in South Carolina is that the needs are really great, and all of these institutions and organizations have realized that we can accomplish more together than we can separately. And so a lot of our work involves partnerships with other community groups. But at the MUSC Hollings Cancer Center, we have a mobile health unit that many people may be familiar with. It looks like an RV, basically. And we've been providing breast and cervical cancer screening to rural and medically underserved women in the Lowcountry region and in the I-95 corridor of South Carolina. And it's really wonderful to be able to go into communities. We partner with federally qualified health centers to make sure that the women who are screened have a referral, that they have a medical home, and that they have a place for the MUSC Hollings Cancer Center physicians to follow up with if the person who's screened has abnormal results that require further diagnostic workup. And so that links people who may not have had a primary care physician, it links them with a primary care facility. So that's good for their future health. And it also allows our navigators at Hollings to work with the women to really help them navigate the process, not only of getting screened, but also all of the diagnostic workup and, if necessary, the treatment that they would receive, either at Hollings or at a health facility that's closer to where they live. And so I am really proud of the mobile health unit because we take responsibility for all of the women who are screened on the unit. Sometimes you hear other organizations in other states who may screen 2,000 people in one day, but then they don't always go the extra step of following up with those women and navigating them and making sure that they get the follow-up care that they need. And so I'm really proud of how Hollings has done this right from the beginning in taking responsibility for the women who are screened on the mobile health unit, navigate them through diagnostic workup and treatment. Communication is key. And if you screen people and then you have no way of communicating the screening results to a physician who can then communicate those results to the person, then you've broken the line of communication. And so that's why we get the referral from the primary healthcare provider, typically at a federally qualified health center. That's our point of communication, as well as contacting the screened participants directly. But we have now a clinician involved in the follow-up care process as well, not just the Hollings clinicians, but a primary care physician. And Hollings Cancer Center has just committed $700,000 to a project, and this is a really exciting project. And I'll give you some background. About 2 years ago, South Carolina ranked last, dead last in the country in our human papillomavirus vaccine rate. That was not a good place to be, but we achieved such a great increase over a 1.5 year period that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention highlighted South Carolina in their Morbidity and Mortality Weekly report. And so we still have a long way to go with the HPV vaccine, but this campaign is dedicated to using multimedia, social media, networking, working with training physicians and training school nurses to communicate with parents and children about the HPV vaccine, and then working with the parents of children who are being trained to become advocates for vaccination. So we are really excited. This project just began last year, but it's statewide. And again, partnerships are the key. And so this is a statewide project that involves other health systems in the state. And we're just really excited.
You are listening to MUSC's Science Cafe podcast. We are fortunate to have with us Dr. Marvella Ford, Professor of Public Health Sciences and Associate Director of Population Health and Cancer Disparities at MUSC's Hollings Cancer Center. You know, what's really interesting about this to me as well is now you're also including a much younger generation of minority population who are learning things that their parents probably never had access to learn. And hopefully it's changing their lives dramatically too. And that brings up to me, I know you do a lot with other South Carolina State University and Claflin University and Voorhees College. And it's a hopeful situation for the future of minorities across the state of South Carolina. Can I ask you, with that hopeful future, how does that affect economic and social impacts of disparity?
Very good. So in 2017, we were awarded a grant with South Carolina State University, and that grant is for $12.5 million. And what I'm really happy about is that the funds were split equally between the two institutions, and each institution received its own notice of award. That means that each institution received half of the $12.5 million, and that really is promoting a lot of growth. I'm so excited about the growth that we're seeing at South Carolina State University.
So you're upping the game.
Yes, we are absolutely upping the game. So previously, South Carolina State University did not have a biorepository. And through the South Carolina Cancer Disparities Research Center grant, or SC Cadre, we have built this new biorepository at SC State. And so they are able to get samples now. We are transferring samples from the MUSC Hollings Cancer Center to the South Carolina State University biorepository. This was historic because it was the first time in history that samples had ever been transferred from either institution. They also have a new mass spectrometry at South Carolina State University, and their biorepository is fully equipped, and that all happened through this SC Cadre grant. So
Marvella, what that tells me is not only is the Medical University of South Carolina and you yourself making a drastic difference in the lives of underrepresented populations to improve their health and welfare, we're also having a great impact on future researchers at historically Black colleges, such as South Carolina State University.
And two of the investigators involved with SC Cadre at South Carolina State University just received a grant that's over $500,000,
wow.
A federal grant. And we're just so thrilled at the potential. And we know that having the biorepository there is really elevating the level of the science that's being conducted at South Carolina State University. And that will bring a lot more federal dollars in grant funding to South Carolina State University.
So can I go back to your personal story? And you said one of the reasons that you were compelled to look into health disparities happened when you were a child and your grandparents were not with you and you wanted to understand why. But you yourself have been through some challenges, health challenges. And what did you learn from that as far as your ability to get the kind of care that you needed where others might not?
So I have been diagnosed with breast cancer twice. The first time was in 2008. And it was diagnosed as stage zero, but grade three. Grade three means that it was highly differentiated and on the move. So at that time, I had excellent treatment at the MUSC Hollings Cancer Center and had a lumpectomy surgery followed by about 7 or 7.5 weeks of daily radiation therapy through the radiation oncology program. And I felt very blessed, because I completely understood that I was in a very privileged position. At that time, my office was in the Hollings Cancer Center. And so I would go into work in the morning. I would have my radiation treatment at radiotherapy at 9 o'clock in the morning, 15 minutes. And then I would be in my office at 9:20 in the morning. And I would see the line of patients pulling up in front of Hollings, and I thought about all the people who live in different areas and the sacrifice that they and their families make to make sure that the patients receive the treatment in a timely manner. And I fully understood that how blessed I was, and that made me even more determined to work harder to make sure that the same opportunities that I have are available to other people as well across the state. In 2013, I had a routine, well, it was actually a follow-up mammogram. After you've had cancer, they're diagnostic mammograms. And it was discovered that I had a new cancer in a different quadrant of the same breast. And again, as I said, when I was diagnosed the first time, I had stage zero, but grade three, which is the highest grade. And so at that time in 2013, and I had a mastectomy followed by reconstruction surgery. And again, having access to some of the best reconstructive breast surgeons in the area was a definite bonus. And I am very appreciative. But I also want to make sure that those options are available to other people throughout the state. And that's why at the Hollings Cancer Center, we've actually partnered with the Seventh Episcopal District of the African Methodist Episcopal Church. And they wrote us into their three-year health ministry plan. They wrote the MUSC Hollings Cancer Center into their three-year health ministry plan. So once a month, we go to a church, an AME church in the I-95 corridor of South Carolina, which is the most medically underserved region of our entire state. It's the most, it's the least economically developed, the most medically underserved area of the state. It's often called the corridor of shame. And we go to a church, we spend about 5 hours there, and we deliver an intervention to people that the church members have recruited themselves. And it's called the Moving Up program. We've been running it since 2007, but now we have a new partnership with the AME church. And we actually give people the tools that they need to take this cancer information to other people in their communities. And so it's very interactive, and we go over basic general cancer knowledge. We have modules focusing on prostate cancer in particular. We have a breast cancer module, a colorectal cancer module, an HPV vaccine module. And so, we give everybody who participates gets a huge binder with all of the information that we discussed. It's in plain language. We give them a memory stick with all the information. And they sign a statement saying that they will give at least 2 sessions in their own communities. Each person will give at least 2 sessions in their own communities in the coming year. And so we've trained more than 500 people in the state, and they've reached more than 5,000 additional people. Wow. And that's what I mean about the importance of having partners, because they increase our reach in getting cancer information out to communities.
You are listening to MUSC's Science Cafe podcast. We are fortunate to have with us Dr. Marvella Ford, Professor of Public Health Sciences and Associate Director of Population Health and Cancer Disparities at MUSC's Hollings Cancer Center. One of the questions I struggle with is, we can go out to a community and talk to them, but there may be sections of a community that say, why should I care? I've got to take care of myself. I can't be bothered helping out with others. In light of the COVID-19 pandemic, what do you say to those people now?
So I think one thing that we've learned from this COVID-19 pandemic is that we are all in this together. And what affects one segment of a community or a population eventually will reach the entire community or population. So right now, people of color are most affected by COVID-19. And that's because of the fact that people of color have higher rates of the chronic health conditions that we discussed earlier. However, other people will also be affected moving forward who are not people of color. So if you're very wealthy and you live in a very secluded community, exclusive community, but you have people in your home who are buying your groceries and bringing them into your home and putting them away and cooking your food, whatever they are exposed to is being brought into your home. And so it just goes to show that we're all one society. And when this COVID-19 pandemic broke out in Wuhan, we were all watching it as if it was a movie, like, ooh, look what's happening over there in China. Wow, look what they're going through. Not realizing that it would come to us as well, that we're now in the movie. And I think we can see that reaction in our country, where a lot of the leaders of Midwestern states are saying, you know, this virus, it's really just affecting the coast, and we're pretty much okay. We're in the middle of the U.S. We're okay. We should be fine. But with the pandemic, nobody's fine. Nobody can be fine when we have a new virus that no one has developed immunity to. No one can be fine. No one is safe. We all have to take precautions. And the problem that we're hearing now is, it may be possible to have an infection from COVID-19, and then it may be possible to get reinfected. New information is emerging every day about the virus. But one thing that it has taught us is that we are really one community. We're one nation. And what happens in California has implications for Colorado. What happens in New York State has implications for Missouri. Even though it may not seem evident right now, because we travel, because we're shipping products and produce and goods and services across state lines, the exposure is present, and there's a high possibility for exposure across our country.
Quite so. Dr. Ford, it's really been a pleasure to spend time with you today. And I think there's so much more we could say about health disparity, and especially as it relates to COVID-19. But you're an optimistic person. So what would you say is the promise of the future with regard to the research of health disparity and the health and well-being of our state, if not our country?
Well, I'm really excited about the fact that so much attention is being drawn right now to health disparities, and that the importance of health disparities in the U.S. is really being identified. And the hope is that there will be more research, more funding for health disparities research, because we've seen we have to address these disparities in our country, or they make the entire country vulnerable. I'm also excited about the fact that these health disparities are being highlighted, because we're now paying attention to the social determinants of health. And now it's better understood that having a low level of education and not having health insurance coverage and not having high quality housing really puts people in a position to face health disparities, and that we have to address the systemic factors that contribute to health disparities. But on an individual level, what we can do to reduce our own personal risk of contracting COVID-19 is, as we've heard, wash our hands frequently, wash our hands well. We want to wash our hands for at least 20 seconds. We want to wash our hands as if we're going into surgery to operate on someone's heart. Every time we wash our hands, 20 seconds, the palms, the backs of the hands, in between the fingers, the thumbs, underneath the fingernails. Also, this is not a time to gather with friends and families. We want to avoid gatherings of people. We also want to wear some type of mask or face covering when we go out into public. And we want to continue to maintain social distancing. It's really important to always maintain that at least minimum 6 feet between each person. This is not a time to relax. This is a time to be vigilant and observant, watchful, and to take action. And it may not seem like much, but the actions that we have taken as a nation have really helped to diminish the impact so far of COVID-19 in our country. And as Americans, we should all be proud of the actions that we've taken together to diminish the spread of this terrible disease in our country.
Not to mention all the great research that's being done to mitigate the consequences of COVID-19, but also the great work that you're doing to mitigate the pain and suffering of those who are underrepresented in our healthcare system. We want to thank Dr. Marvella Ford for joining us today to talk about health disparities. Dr. Ford is a professor of public health sciences and associate director of population sciences and cancer disparities at MUSC's Hollings Cancer Center.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure talking with you today, and I hope the information is helpful to many people in our state and beyond.
Join us next time when Dr. Patrick Flume will discuss with us cystic fibrosis and some very exciting therapies on the horizon. I'm Loretta Lynch Reichert, Director of Research Communications at the Medical University of South Carolina and host of MUSC's Science Cafe. Thank you for joining us. Please stay safe.